Coming up next on the Marathon Handbook podcast, I chat with my colleague, news editor Jesse Carvith. We talk about a really busy week for her on the site, all the stories she's been covering, including this weird one, California Marathon. The winner, or I guess would-be winner, was disqualified after essentially taking a couple of sips of water. Then she explains for me what the heck is going on with Olympic marathon qualification. The qualification window is now closed, so we should have a good idea of who is running the marathon for each country. Of course, there's quite a bit of controversy around who's going to get to run and who's not. And it seems as though one of the Americans that we reported earlier this week had qualified is now going to get screwed out of a position. So Team USA is actually only sending five instead of a team of six, which is totally wild. We unpack that. Then we get into the Kenyan team. Now, this is important because Kenya is always one of the top countries in the world in terms of marathoners. You can count on at least one Kenyan being on the podium in each of the women's and the men's marathon races. Eliud Kipchoge, the goat, maybe in the marathon. He's coming back, but there's a lot of, shall we say, conspiratorial noise around the selection process and who was picked for the Kenyan team in the marathons and Nike's outsized influence on that selection process. So Jesse explains all that to us. And we also talk about this crazy world record that was just set. I'll give you a little teaser. 1,000 marathons and the overall average time of those 1,000 marathons. Yeah. And finally, zombies. This episode is brought to you by MarathonHandbook.com, where we've got a lot going on right now. On our site, multiple news stories a day. Our news editor, Jesse, is absolutely crushing it. She's got her fingers on the pulse of the scene. Our YouTube channel, posting something new pretty much every day. Alex Sear, he's doing these amazing shoe reviews. Even if you have no interest in the shoe whatsoever, his mission right now is to make an entertaining video regardless of what the shoe in particular is that's being reviewed. They're really good. They're quite funny. And he's also doing these shorts as well that he's putting out on IG Reels. He's putting out on TikTok and YouTube Shorts. Follow us on socials, of course. We're on all social platforms. And subscribe to our newsletter. More than 160,000 runners subscribe to our newsletter. It goes out three times a week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Mondays and Wednesdays are great. It's a resource for news, for training. It's put together by our team. It's all killer, no filler. We really pride ourselves in only putting in the best content. And Fridays is a special one. Our editor emeritus, Ambi Barefoot, who you may know the name, he won the 1967 Boston Marathon. He was a longtime editor-in-chief at Runner's World. He writes this extraordinary newsletter for us that goes out every Friday that is jam-packed with thought-provoking content, and it's a must-read. Absolutely, you got to check it out. The newsletter is something that we really put a lot of effort into. And 160,000 plus people can't be wrong, right? All right, let's get into the podcast. All right, I'm here with our senior news editor, Jesse Carvith. Jesse, we're gonna chat once a week, and we're gonna get into what you're covering, what's on the site, the stories that you've been looking at. And surprisingly, this week's been pretty busy. Usually, it's like kind of quiet mid-May, but there's been a slew of stories. So we got a lot to talk about today. We'll see if we can cover it all off pretty quickly here. First one that jumps out is Orange County Marathon. Not a big race, not a race that we would normally cover, but it's surfaced and been chatted about quite a bit, popped up on Reddit. You identified this story. the guy who won the race got DQ'd for a really kind of interesting and unusual reason. Like, tell us a little bit about what happened in Orange County.
Yeah, so this runner, Esteban Prado, he finished first at the race. He crossed the line in 2:24:54. And then shortly after, he was told that he was disqualified. So during the race, turns out his father was on a bike next to him throughout the course and was also handing him water. There's lots of video evidence online showing it. And not only is the cup of water kind of the issue, but people are highlighting that they suspect some pacing for a portion of the course, which kind of is a big issue. So yeah, second place was awarded as the winner, and Esteban Prado was disqualified.
I mean, that's brutal, right? Like, you cross the finish line, and I think he ran a pretty good race. I can't remember whether or not it was a PR, but, you know, 220, just under 225 is a very good performance. Obviously worked very hard. And then you get told that you've been DQ'd. That must be like a real gut punch for that to happen. The video actually that you embedded on the story, from a local news channel was pretty great, because it was quite thorough. Like, they talked to him, they talked to the race organizers, I believe. They also spoke with the guy who was in second place, who got elevated to first place. And we can talk about that in a second, because it was an interesting interview. But my take on this is, I understand the importance of this rule. I understand that on a like super bleeding edge elite level, like if the stakes were extremely high, tens of thousands of dollars, you're talking about like New York, Boston, something like that, obviously this would not fly, because it's an unfair advantage to the person in the lead. But like, I know this is going to sound crazy, because 224 is a really great time, but it's sub elite. It's not elite. And maybe there was a bit of money at stake, if I'm not mistaken, but not a crazy amount of money. These people aren't doing this for a living. And I kind of feel like the main reason why you're out there running at this level is for the time, for the performance. And I think it just sucks for this guy that he did run the time and he's getting this time taken away from him. Like, the win aside, right? I mean, that's an ego thing. The actual time itself is valuable for him. Like, I don't know, just qualifying for Boston or something like that. Like, now he's got to do another marathon in order to have that time. What's your take on this? Do you think that it was fair that he got DQ'd?
So here's my thing. I think when issues like this come up, a lot of people say, oh, like, that was such a stupid rule. Like, he shouldn't have been DQ'd. Mm-hmm. But in the end, like, the rule is there. It's been there. It's printed out. It's in the rule book. And everyone has to follow it. So I think there's almost like two levels of thought there. The first is looking at the rule itself. Should the rule be changed? Should the rule exist? Yeah. And then the other school of thought is like, okay, the runner did this. They broke the rule, regardless of whether the rule is stupid or not. They broke the rule. So it might sound kind of harsh, but he did break a rule, which
Jesse, you're the rules person.
I know. Here's the thing. In cycling, for example, we have a laundry list of silly rules. Like, for example, sock height. Hmm. If your socks are above a certain height, that breaks the rules, and you can like lose UCI points. You could get disqualified. Yada yada. It's a stupid your sock height. How tall your socks are. That's an insane rule, right?
Yep.
But we follow it. And if you break it, you have to suffer the consequences. So yeah, I think kind of my rigid cycling rules are kind of coming into play here, but the rules might be stupid, but they're there, and he broke it. So yeah, it might be harsh, but I think the DQ was fair.
One little caveat with this, my gentle pushback to your rules or rules take is that he did point out that the race was like woefully inadequate when it came to supporting him on the course. Like, and there was in that video clip that you posted, there is ample evidence that he's like blowing through the water stations and the volunteers just aren't ready for him. Like, they don't have water or hydration fluid or whatever out on the course for him. They obviously didn't have like elite stations for hydration. So, I mean, his argument was, well, like, I need to take something in, and my dad was there handing it to me. My issue is actually more with, and this is what was pointed out on the subreddit that was kind of like lighting a fire the other day, which is my issue is more like he's getting paced by his dad on a bike. And that's a real aid, because
yeah,
if you've ever been like deep in a race and you're all by yourself at any level, whether you're in first or 500th place, if you're like out there alone trying to battle your own mind, it's very, very easy to let up and to go easy on yourself. And so when you've got someone there next to you pushing you, it helps you. And obviously the guy in second place presumably did not have any help and wasn't running with anybody. So, I mean, he definitely got help in that capacity. The other thing that kind of rubs me the wrong way is like, I kind of feel like the race organizers were being a bit disingenuous here and not owning their decision, because they said that they were forced to disqualify him. But if you like dig into the US Track and Field Association rule book, it's kind of to their discretion. And if they wanted to fall on their own sword and say like, yeah, mea culpa, we did not support this guy enough on the course. Our volunteers were not ready. He was jumping on them way too quick, flying through. They weren't, you know, ready to hand off fluid to him in time. So like we can kind of let this slide because we kind of failed him in this race. They could have done that. And so it leads me to this question, Jesse. This is like a little conspiratorial moment here is who ratted him out? Who complained?
By the sounds of it, it was the runner in second place. And that was what I was about to say. I'm like, that's probably why they decided to kind of stick to the rules there, is because, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it was
right.
The runner in second, because he was the only one that would have been able to see him, reportedly.
Gotcha. So this dude, Jason Yang, he was actually really close behind. So I do get the reason why the guy was upset, because he was probably like trying desperately to hunt him down in the last couple of miles and you know, didn't do so, and was watching him get help from his dad up in front, and was probably just boiling with rage the entire time, which maybe helped Jason Yang run faster, because he was probably motivated because he was pissed off that this guy in front of him is getting help.
It could have demoralized him a bit too, though.
Or could have done that, yeah. So he ran 2:25.11, so he wasn't very far behind. And like, if you've not read Jesse's story, if you've not watched the video, go to our site. And I'm not just merely plugging this so you go to our site, but like, go watch the video clip, because it's really kind of interesting. It's like a little, like, there's a little story within a story definitely playing out there, because this Yang dude was like, he was like kind of smug about the whole thing. He was like, kind of like, yeah, I should be first place. Like, screw that guy. He was not at all like, oh, you know, usually you'd get the, you know, I just really feel really bad that Prado, like, he ran such a good race and it sucks that he got disqualified. You know, it's not the way I want to win or whatever, like the false modesty thing. But he did not do any of that at all. So
there's a little bit of marathon beef going on there.
Total
and
beef.
Afterwards too, Prado was like, I know I won. So you can kind of tell they're not best of friends. You can bet that.
Yeah. So I guess the takeaway is rules are rules, but it still kind of sucks that this guy, there's like cheating and then there's cheating. He didn't cut the course, right? Like, he still ran the race. His legs still did the running, right? So yeah, I feel bad for Prado, but I guess you're right, Jesse. Rules are rules. So Prado ran 2:24 high. That's an impressive time. But you know what might be a more impressive time?
What?
The number 1,000 in front of the word marathons. So this story, like, I have to admit, I didn't know who this guy is. But break down for me this story you wrote this week about this UK dude who has run 1,000 marathons and broken the world record for the best overall average for someone who's run 1,000 marathons.
Yeah. So Steve Edwards is his name, and he recently finished his 1,000th marathon. That's a tongue twister, eh?
Yeah.
He's become just the 51st person to do so, but along the way, he also claimed the Guinness World Record for fastest aggregate time to complete 1,000 marathons. So his average finishing time is 3:21:57, which kind of, you know, that's really impressive. It blows a lot of other regular runners' PRs out of the water. And he's completed that over 43 years, and he is now 61. Right. So
I love the little bit in your story where basically this, like the kind of the origin of all of this, of his insane odyssey to run 1,000 marathons, began with, like, ironically, him saying as a teenager after running his first marathon, like, he uttered the words like, never again, or something like that, at the finish line.
Yeah, he was walking down the stairs the next day and he was like, never again. Came addicted to the runner's high, like everyone does.
But this is nuts, right? Okay, first of all, I have to admit, I did not know there were 50 people or 51 people in the world who've run 1,000 marathons. I know people keep track of this stuff. I know that there's an organization that sort of that tracks, you can self-submit how many marathons you've run. And there's the Century Club, 100 marathons, 200, 500, whatever. I did not know there was 51 people that have done 1,000 marathons. That's bananas. And like 3:21 to average for 1,000 marathons.
And do you want to know what makes that even more impressive? So I recently found out while I was, you know, making my show notes for today that he also has this blood disorder called beta thalassemia minor. Might have said that a bit wrong, but I'm no doctor. Okay. So essentially, it affects like the oxygen carrying capacity of his blood cells. And so he's essentially living in a mild state of anemia or iron deficiency permanently, which, as a lot of runners know, is kind of like a massive fear for all of us, is having low iron, because it just crashes your energy. So I think that kind of just makes, I found that out and that just kind of blew my mind, made it all the more impressive.
Or like completely and totally masochistic and insane. Like just running that many marathons, period, and having to like, just having to do that. I think about this with people just with like a run streak as a simplified version of this, right? Just committing yourself to running every single day and never taking a day off and like trying to hobble your way through injury, or like a streak where you're kind of like low energy or down or high stress in life. Cause the vast majority of people who do this stuff we're just like, you know, just, I was going to say like you or I, but you're actually a professional athlete and I am not. So like, just like me, who is like a recreational runner, right? Effectively. So, doing this with like in a perpetual state of anemia sounds like a form of torture. But yeah, so that's like, what is that? 1,000 marathons over 43 years. You did the math on this. It's like,
yeah. So that's a marathon every 13 days for the last 36 years. And then in 1 year he ran 87 marathons, and that equaled out to a marathon every 4.2 days.
So that's when he was still really eager, and then he's faded to one every couple of weeks.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But every 4.2 days is absolutely nuts.
Imagine
that.
Can you imagine just being like, I have to do a marathon more or less every other weekend?
No,
that sounds awful.
Even thinking about running one marathon is a lot.
it's a daunting task. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it just becomes he has a different relationship with it than you or I would, right? Like he probably just sees it as like, I have to go out and run my 26.2 or better long run in order to keep things moving along here. I also wonder like,
well, they were all official marathons. They all had to be official marathons. They weren't just, they weren't just runs. They were like, he signed up online and went to the start line. Yeah.
Just finding that number of marathons over the course of 43 years is its own full-time job, really.
Yeah.
But he had a job.
he was an IT guy. Yeah.
The more we dig into this story, the more kind of complex really kind of wowing, but also insane it is. Like,
yeah.
He must have traveled all over the place just desperately trying to find a marathon. Like, basically any marathon that was within, you know, driving distance or maybe even a short flight, he must have just jumped on over and over and over again.
Yeah. It's insane.
This is a wild one. Yeah. So I what do you think's more impressive? 1,000 marathons, the 1,000 marathons with the time, or the fact that he ran like 80 whatever, because that's also a record, right? The 80 something.
Yeah, that was the most in a year. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a tough one.
I think I think it's the time. I think the fact that he did 1,000 and averaged better than most people like have for a lifetime PR is like, that's a real commitment. That means that a lot of those marathons, he probably ran really well.
Well, I actually found an interview after he had completed, like, I believe it was 903 of his marathons.
Okay.
And he said he, at that time, he had clocked already 300 sub 315s. And most of his marathons, and around 750 of them at that time, had been sub 330. Oh. So it's absolutely insane.
What's his PR, I wonder? What's...
That was one I couldn't find. I'd love to just find a list of all the races he's done.
I always wonder, it's like this sort of philosophical question for a runner, for a distance runner. It's like, do you go for quantity or quality? And at what point... Yeah. Does the quality become such a daunting pursuit that you give up and you go quantity, right? Where you're like, there's no way I'm going to run better than I ran, you know, X number of years ago when I ran my PR. I'm just going to give up on that. And now I'm going to focus on something else. And in his case, I'm going to focus on just running as many races as I possibly can. I guess he made that decision early though.
I think so. Yeah. I think when he decided to do 87 marathons in a year, he probably made that choice.
He's either like the most fascinating running dude to talk to because he's run every marathon you can possibly think of, I imagine. And he's had so many different experiences, or he's like the ultimate running nerd you want to avoid talking to, one or the other.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Like lives in a box.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. We'll take a break. And after this, we'll come back and we're going to talk about universality places. Do I get that right? In the Olympics?
Universality places
in the Olympic marathon. And we'll explain what that is and why that's screwing over one really good American marathoner. Okay, we'll be right back. Then we're back. Jesse, universality places in the upcoming Paris Olympics. What are they and why are they kind of a big deal this time around?
Right. So the universality places, in simple terms, are meant for countries who typically send really small contingents to the Olympic Games, so they don't have a lot of athletes. So the information about them right now, especially via World Athletics, is almost non-existent. But essentially in athletics, any country who hasn't qualified an athlete can enter their highest ranked athlete into either the 100 meter, the 800 meter, or the marathon.
All right.
So, yeah, that's essentially what they are in simple terms. And the Olympics have these essentially to promote internationality because it's an international event and they want to make sure that all the countries are represented and whatnot. So that's what these universality places are in place for.
Right. So you put together a list that we put together a story sort of explaining what this is and who these athletes are that could be entered into the Olympic marathon. I mean, in some cases, some of these athletes like are no joke, are pretty good. And we're very close to the Olympic qualifying times. Like this one dude, Dario Ivanovsky from North Macedonia, and he ran a 208.26. So he was like 16 seconds off the Olympic qualifying time. So he almost made it into the qualifier. That's pretty good. You got a couple of people around the 209-211 range for the men. But then you also have people who've never run a marathon before that are getting in.
Yeah, literally. So on the men's and women's side, each there's one runner who has never run a marathon. So on the men's side, it's Yassin Abdallah of Sudan. So this guy actually has quite a bit of information about him because he's actually an NCAA standout.
Okay.
So he's podiumed at like conference championships, so the SEC and Big 12, which are really big conferences in the NCAA. And he's also podiumed at NCAA national championships. However, the events that he's podiumed on are not the marathon. They range from the 3K to the 10K on the track, which are very far from a marathon. And yes. I mean, to his credit, he does have some impressive PBs. He's a sub 4 miler. I believe his best is a 3:57.53. He's done a 7:42.43 3000 meter, 13:33 5K, and a 28:33 10,000, which are all really impressive times, but they're not a marathon.
No.
And he's not even run a half yet either. So I think the lack of experience is a bit of an Achilles heel there.
My first marathon, the 2024 Paris Olympics. I mean, it's a nice story,
yeah.
But
like, yeah.
But the Paris, but the Olympic marathon is a big deal, and it's a hotly contested event to get into. And the reason why we're talking about this, beyond just kind of like it's interesting and it's kind of it's a neat thing to know about. Like, you think about these Olympic marathons and you're watching them on TV or streaming them this summer. And there are many runners. There'll be probably like 80-ish or more athletes in each field. And it is interesting to kind of get an understanding of how they make these decisions. But the real reason why we're talking about this is because one of the American hopefuls is kind of getting screwed here because of this universality element of it. Like, so Leonard Carrier, who was third at the U.S. Olympic trials in early March, but did not run the Olympic standard of 2:08.10 in the window where he needed to run it. So he was like a question mark. So he was not in. Then you wrote earlier this week that he was in, and then now he's out. Like, walk us through what the hell is going on with Lenny Carrier.
Okay, so the Olympic qualification process this year was, or the last 2 years, I guess, was just super complicated, honestly. So Essentially, World Athletics set out these auto standards. And if you hit the auto standard, you got a spot in the Olympic marathon. Okay. Right. And they wanted to have 50% of their athletes earn their spot to the Olympics that way. The other half they wanted to earn through rankings. So essentially, World Athletics made this big list called the Road to Paris list. And it's the rankings of all the track and field athletes in each of the disciplines. And there's one for the marathon as well. And the second half of the 80 entries was going to come from there. But what actually happened here is 70 athletes qualified via standard. And the other 10, initially, a couple days ago when I looked at the list, after the qualification period, were given to the highest ranked athletes. And
right.
Leonard Carrier actually wasn't the highest American. It was CJ Albertson. But
okay.
because Carrier came third at trials, USA TF can switch their athletes.
Ah, so it's like a quota thing. It's not
exactly.
It's like a placeholder. Like, if you've got a person who has ranked in the top 80, mm-hmm. you're that person has grabbed a quota spot for the country.
Exactly. So essentially, like, when Connor Mance and Clayton Young ran standard at Chicago, they didn't get themselves into the Olympics. They got two spots on the start line for Team USA.
Okay.
They had to place top two in Olympic trials, which they did, to take those spots. But say CJ Albertson won trials, then he would have taken one of those spots. So
right.
US is a bit weird in that they do a trials, whereas most countries just send the athletes that have the highest times or highest ranked. So what happened with Carrier is that initially, after the window had closed on May 5th, I went and I checked the list and he was going. He was there. US had their spot.
Yeah.
And then a couple days later, I went and looked again, and all of the ranked athletes were gone. There was a zero next to that. And the number 11 was next to universality places. So then I decided to do a bit of digging to see what those were. And yeah, it turns out most of the athletes made it through standard, and the rest are coming from these universality places, and no one is making it through the rankings.
That's bananas. Like, they came up with this ridiculous system that confused the hell out of all of us for like the better part of a year. They're like, no, guys, trust us. This is going to make it more interesting and more equitable. And then they're just at the last second, they're like, to hell with it. We're just like, we're chucking this. We're going all on time standards. And also like, forget it. You know, you just made this big effort to try to figure out your way into the Olympics, and nah, we're not doing that anymore. I mean, it's kind of wild.
And that's the thing. And it's not even Courier that's the only one that got screwed over. But the other 9-10 athletes who were banking on ranking spots to qualify also got screwed over. You know, like Courier and the rest of the world who was paying attention to the Olympic marathon was assuming that 10 people were going to qualify via the ranking. And then they opened it up the next day and they see that someone who's never run a marathon is taking their spot instead.
That hurts. So my take on this is we because the Olympics are international, ubiquitous, with summer and winter, they're every 2 years. They're kind of like this incredibly self-important organization. They act kind of like a quasi-governmental or supra-international, like they're like the UN of sports or whatever. We lose sight of the fact that this is a goddamn television show and this is all made up. This isn't real. This is just like, we've come up with this, or they've come up with this, and it's a huge business, right? So who's the number one stakeholder in the Olympics? It's NBC, who pays a massive amount of money, a multi-billion dollar deal to have the rights to the broadcast in the United States. So the single biggest stakeholder in the Olympics is a U.S. television broadcaster and online streaming service. Like, if I were them right now, I'd be making a call and I'd be like, you know what? Kind of important that we have 6 athletes in both of the marathons because it's our TV show, guys. And if I were like USATF, I would also be freaking out about this and I'd be totally going to bat for Leonard Courier, because you want to have 3 shots at the podium, not 2 shots. And he's a good runner. He's on paper, he's as good as the other 2 guys that are going. Like, he's got a 207 high PR in the marathon that he ran in 2019, so not that long ago. I mean, he is 37, so he's sort of getting up there, but like, he's a very competent runner. He ran a great US Olympic trials run. Like, he sort of came back from the dead in the second half of that race and ran down a bunch of people in order to get himself onto that third spot and presumably onto the team. I feel badly for the guy. I think this is BS. I think he should be going. And I think this is all a TV show. Like, make it the most entertaining thing possible. What are we doing here? You know, maybe I'm like pro America right now, but like, I
totally agree. I think World Athletics, I think the IOC, I think they 100% got it wrong here. Not just with like the Courier ranking situation, but just with the qualification process in general.
Yeah.
Like, they made this qualification process that, like you said, is hard for any regular person to follow, let alone like an elite runner. I can't imagine being an athlete trying to figure this out. Like, that's just super stressful. And you can't even follow your qualification system. It's one thing if this is what they said from the beginning. It's like, you either make standard or you get a universality place. Like, okay, if you said that from the beginning, that's great. That's what you decided to do. But yeah, to change it last minute, I think is just so, and after the window too. So it's not even like he knows for sure he's not getting a spot, but now he doesn't even have the chance to go back and try to get a spot, you know, cause it's after the qualification period.
It's all said.
He can't run the standard. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, it's brutal. I feel for the guy.
The IOC's got to get their act together. I think what they're not realizing and not accepting is that like the track and field athletics is the biggest single and most important. It's the crown jewel of the Summer Olympic Games. It's the most important component of the Olympics. And things are changing. There's track leagues forming that are going to directly compete with and conflict with the Olympics and the Olympic movement, and we'll start professionalizing this sport. And these athletes will start to see their value and start to see that they're being used as free labor right now by the Olympic movement, which is just a gigantic TV show and a business. And they'll be like, you know what? I'd rather go run for a league, a pro league that's going to pay me what I'm worth or some semblance of what I'm worth. And over time, this sort of nonsense hopefully won't happen anymore if the Olympics is still around in, say, 20 years, which, you know, I'm sure it will be. It's a huge business. But so sort of staying in that headspace, and to continue on the outrage train, earlier in the week, and I thought it'd be good to talk about this, cause it kind of, it falls under this umbrella as well. Earlier in the week, at the beginning of this week, the Kenyan Olympic teams, Olympic marathon squads were formally announced, and there was like quite a bit of controversy around this as well. And you wrote an awesome piece about it. I love your headline. You called it a swoosh affair because of Nike's influence potentially on the decision-making for who is going to run in the Olympic marathons for the Kenyan national team. So who was selected, and why has this caused a kerfuffle?
Okay. Well, the main area of kerfuffle is in the women's selection. Okay. So it was Perez Jepchirchir, Bridget Kosgei, and Helen Obiri who were selected. And the kind of red flag there is Bridget Kosgei. Mm-hmm. Now, don't get me wrong. She is one of the best marathoners around. She's the former world record holder. But she was also selected over two runners who were on the short list, because there was five athletes on the short list who are in far better form than her right now. Rosemary Wanjiru and Sharon Lokedi. So essentially, I'm going to give it to you short. Wanjiru and Lokedi have outshined Kosgei by far over the last 2 years. Wanjiru has run the fastest time by a Kenyan this year, which is 2:16:14. That was when she placed second at the Tokyo Marathon. And Lokedi beat Kosgei head-to-head at the New York City Marathon, just seven months ago. She placed second behind Helen Obiri, who I think right now is just on fire, so I'm excited to see her run. So where it gets interesting is with the swoosh affair. So Bridget Kosgei is a Nike-sponsored athlete, whereas Lokedi and Wanjiru are not. Athletics Kenya is also Nike-sponsored, and it's important to notice that this is not the first time a Nike-sponsored athlete has made the Kenyan team over a non-Nike-sponsored athlete. So in 2012, Moses Mosop, who is a Nike athlete, was selected over Jeffrey Mutai, Patrick Macau, and Emmanuel Mutai, who were all Adidas athletes.
Right.
In 2016, Vicelyne Jepkesho, a Nike athlete, was selected over Mary Katani, an Adidas athlete on the women's side, while Wesley Corrier, a Nike athlete, was selected to the men's team despite going 4 years without a podium finish in any marathon.
Wesley Corrier, lovely man, by the way. I've interviewed him in the past because he's spent quite a bit of time in Canada over the years. He's married to a Canadian. Lovely guy. Won the Boston Marathon. Great story. Great human being. Good ambassador for the sport. Probably shouldn't have gone to the Olympics representing Kenya, particularly in that moment in his career. I think this is also like, if you're a fan of this sport, you're looking at this, and it's a huge mistake for Kenya. Because,
oh yeah,
if they don't pull away, I would say if they're not, you know, they've got a chance to go 1, 2, 3 on the podium every time, right?
Yeah.
And certainly contend for top five, certainly top 10, in each Olympic marathon. I mean, they have a number of the best athletes in the world every single year. Between Kenya and Ethiopia, I mean, the center of this sport at that level, in the marathon, for sure. I think Lucchetti is like totally getting screwed because not only has she performed really well, she's done so on courses that are very similar to what it's going to be like running the Paris Olympic marathon. So Paris's course is hilly. Yeah. And the race is not paced. Olympic marathons do not have pacers. And New York City is very hilly. Boston is very hilly. Neither of those races are paced. So if you're looking, if you're trying to make an informed decision about who is going to excel, who's going to give you the best chance to podium in Paris, I would be looking at New York and Boston performances first and foremost. And then I'd be looking at just overall talent level speed secondarily, and whether or not you're like peaking and you're at the peak of your powers right now, right? And like Lucchetti, yeah, it's like, come on, she won New York. She placed third in New York last year. She won in New York in 2022, and then she placed second, and it was a pretty close second in Boston, where she kind of hung in there until sort of the last mile of the race effectively, and also ran really, really well. So she's a gamer. I mean, it's a no-brainer. However, there's one problem with Lucchetti. You know what the problem is with her?
What's the problem?
She's effectively American. She lives in the United States. She trains in the United States. She's been in the United States. I think she went to Kansas or Kansas State. So she's been in the U.S. for a number of years. She's really far away from that epicenter of Kenyan athletics, right? So, you know, she's kind of, I guess, maybe like not one of them in a certain respect, right? Or she's not part of that inner circle of athletes. And yeah, I don't know what her agent and coaching situation is like, but it seems like she's getting screwed here in particular. That sucks. I got a question for you, and this is maybe like sort of wandering into hot take territory.
All right.
Before we kind of move on from this. Eliud Kipchoge, did he earn his spot? Besides like it's getting the emeritus spot, did he like really, if you were to do like a blind analysis of like the last 18 months of running, like would Kipchoge be the guy that your team would select?
I have so many arguments for and against him. I've been on the fence about Kipchoge for a long, long time now. Today, this is my today answer, could change tomorrow. Okay. It was probably different yesterday. But today, I'm leaning for Kipchoge, I think.
Okay.
Now, you're
zagging.
Why.
You're zigging. Is that a zag?
A zag, I think, because my zig initially is no. Most of the time I've been kind of leaning towards the no, so I think this is a zag. Here's why. All right. I recently wrote the story about the online abuse he was getting after Kelvin Kiptum's unfortunate passing. And he was in a really, really tough spot, especially going into Tokyo. Like, he was saying that, you know, it wasn't just affecting him, it was affecting his family. He, you know, was losing sleep over it, you know, didn't feel safe to train. And like, I was really able to sympathize with that because as an athlete myself, I know how important like being in a good headspace is to perform no matter what your fitness level is. Like, for example, last summer I was in a bad spot mentally for like a couple months after I changed teams mid-season, but I was at like my best fitness I had been at the time, but I couldn't get around like a local town center race. Like, that was an hour long just because I just wasn't happy. Like, I was, yeah, you know, like not having a good time, but I was super fit. And so that kind of part of me, I think it's because I really sympathize with, like, you know, I think at the time no one really knew how much it was affecting him, but now he's like opened up about it. And I'm like, if he can kind of move past that and like get himself into a good headspace, he's still really talented. Like, he ran sub 2:03 at Berlin last year. You know, like, he's still the GOAT. He's so, right now I want to believe in him. But the other part of me that doesn't is the course. He doesn't have a good track record on challenging courses like, say, Evans Chebet.
Yeah. I mean, you just made a really good point that I must admit I've never thought of that. He's a human being and he was deeply affected by this. And I think it's pretty callous of us to just dismiss that as not a factor. And he's this guy who's supposed to be able to, he's like impervious to all this. And maybe, and this is not to criticize him, but maybe part of the lure of like the sort of like, the mythology that is Eliud Kipchoge, the sort of like philosopher king, the Yoda of running, is like, oh, he's the ultimate master of his own sort of mental approach to the game of marathoning, and he can overcome any sort of mental barrier or challenge. But I mean, it sounds like this was actually a pretty significant and pretty haunting experience for him. So yeah, that's a smart perspective that I'd not considered. But you also make a really good point that this is also a guy who's got like a pretty spotty track record when it comes to an undulating or a hilly course or adverse conditions. Like he also struggled mightily, if you remember, during that like weird pandemic London marathon. It was rainy and cold, and there was like a side wind. There was like a nasty sort of crosswind, and he stitched up and had an issue with, I think his leg was cramping, or he basically fell apart in the race. And the last couple of Olympic marathons have been relatively straightforward affairs, right? Like, Rio was warm, but it was a relatively flat course. And he was also kind of like at the peak of his powers. And he also had the help of the super shoes when no one else knew that they existed. Mm-hmm. And then Tokyo, of course, until this year, he'd run pretty well in Japan, and it was a flat course as well. So yeah, it's really interesting. I think this is like, I mean, we'll talk about this in more detail when the Olympics get closer, but I think that's a pretty like wide open race in the men's marathon for sure. Maybe a little tighter in the women's race, although there's a lot of interesting contenders there as well. We'll get into that down the road. Let's take a quick break, but before we wrap up for the day, I just wanted to touch on like one piece that you wrote that is not about elite athletes. It's not about weird records. It's about zombies. Be right back. All right, and we're back. Last topic of the day, zombies. Yeah, let's talk about zombies, Jesse.
Why not?
Yeah, so this is a fun one. You did a story earlier this week about the forthcoming film that's in production. It's the third in, I guess now, a trilogy of films, the 28 trilogy, we'll call it now, which began with 28 Days Later, which is this kind of, I'd say, important film in the history of cinema for a few different reasons. One being that it's a zombie post-apocalyptic film that feels like it was like right on the vanguard of both technological change in the cinema and also the whole zombie post-apocalyptic obsession that we've spent like, I don't know, the last 20 years mining to death. No pun intended. But this film came out in the summer of 2003. I remember I was in university. I remember when it came out. I went and saw it in the movie theater. It was totally horrifying. You've not seen it, right? You've not seen this film.
I would have been 2 when that came out.
Yikes. Wow. Okay. So I recommend you fire this one up on Netflix or wherever it is. It can be streamed now. I'm not sure what platform it's on. It's really neat. It was shot on digital video, so it looks like hyper real and it's really kind of disturbing and creepy. And one of the big shifts in the horror genre and the zombie post-apocalyptic genre with this movie was up until that point, like the George A. Romero horror movies were like slow zombies, right? They're like the like foot dragging zombie, and you always sort of had an opportunity to get away from them, but they were kind of relentless. And in 28 Days Later, they were fast zombies for the first time. So they were like zombies on steroids, basically. So there's the third film is being made right now. It's being shot in the north of England. It's called 28 Years Later. So there's 28 Days Later, 28 Weeks Later was the second film. This third film is 28 Years Later. And they've got a call out for like a massive amount of extras, presumably to play both terrified people running away from fast zombies and the fast zombies themselves, right? So my question for you, Jesse, would you rather be a fast zombie covered in zombie makeup chasing after people or doing your best terrified person acting performance, your Oscar-winning performance, running away from zombies for a day on a movie set?
So initially, I thought I would 100% want to be one of the people acting terrified because I was like, I don't want to sit around in like zombie clothes all sweaty with all that makeup and, you know, it probably gets itchy and stuff. But then I remembered how much I laugh. And I think that I don't think I could be a terrified person because I think I would just start laughing and smiling as I was running, like looking back. I'd probably just turn and smile. So I think it would be better to cover my expression with makeup. So I think I would have to be a zombie. I don't think I could be a normal person.
Yeah, I was talking about this with a friend of mine who's he's an extra in the upcoming Guillermo del Toro version of the Frankenstein movie that's being shot right now in Toronto. And he's like in a scene where I guess he's playing like someone in the College of Scientists or Doctors or whatever that's like operating on Frankenstein. And he was totally freaked out because he was like, what if I look at the camera? Or like, what if I start laughing? Or what if I get that like nervous smiling thing I get? And I'm like, I don't know, dude, like then they're going to fire you from the set. Like being an extra is probably pretty hard, right? Like the camera is just looming there, right? I mean, it's hard enough to do a video podcast. Imagine doing a feature film.
Well, on my cycling team at our training camp, actually, I became known for being a serial waver because I was really good at finding where our photographer was hiding in the trees, and I would just smile and wave. So I'd probably do that on a movie set too.
Yeah, so you should be a zombie then. I'd probably rather be the like person terrified running in fear because I think
you could pull it off.
Thank you.
And
I also think it would really suck to be just like in makeup for what, 4 hours a day or whatever. That'd be super gross. Anyway, I'm excited about this movie. I'm sure it'll come out at some point next year. I'm curious to see what it looks like. I mean, Danny Boyle, the guy who directed it, is a Academy Award nominated and Academy Award winning filmmaker. And has done a lot of interesting stuff over the years, including Trainspotting, which is a cult classic. So, and I think Cillian Murphy reprising the role of the main character, I wonder, because he was the dude who played Oppenheimer. Mm-hmm. He was in the first 28 Days Later film. So I don't know, kind of a neat one. It's always neat when like, they specifically like the casting call was like specifically calling out, like, we need runners. It said like runners, ultra marathon runners for some reason.
It was like ultra runners, triathletes and cyclists who look very fit or something like that. Like they had to look really fit. Like they had to be like lean beans. Like, yeah.
Yeah, ultra runners. That's weird. Like, are they going to do super long takes? I don't know why they would need an ultra runner versus just like a decent distance runner. But anyway, All right. So that's our show for today. We got a lot going on right now. We're doing this pod. We're going to try to do a podcast twice a week, and we're going to settle into a schedule soon enough. And we'll make sure that we promote the hell out of that schedule so that you know when we're coming. We're just sort of sorting this out right now. And thanks to everybody who's been listening and watching so far. We've had a lot of great feedback and it's been really great. So you can subscribe to the podcast wherever you get podcasts. You can watch us. Every podcast will be put on YouTube as well as a video podcast. So you can watch that. And we also are going to do a bunch of little breakout clips as well of each segment. And follow us on socials and make sure you read Jessie's stuff. She's putting multiple stories out every single day. And we've got a newsletter you can sign up for on our site. We send it out 3 times a week and it's nothing but quality. Jessie produces one of them every week and they are excellent. So make sure you get our newsletter as well. 160,000+ people subscribe to the newsletter right now, which is kind of wild to think about. I try not to think about it when we hit send.
I try not to go on the main page of the website because that's where all the numbers are and it freaks me out a bit.
Yeah, but it's great and I highly recommend it. And I'm not just saying that because we're the ones who make it. I'm pretty proud of it. It's worth it. So, all right, we'll talk to you soon.